Debt is the new fat, someone said recently, which led me to reflect that not so long ago, fat was the new cigarette smoking, and before that, cigarette smoking was the new alcohol drinking, and before that, alcohol drinking was the new whoremongering, and whoremongering is the new debt, and so we go in circles.
Welcome to Book Tour. I am Netta Ulaby. Author Margaret Atwood does not usually write about debt. Her books are psychologically elegant imaginings of futuristic dystopias like The Handmaid's Tale, historical fiction, and poems. But Atwood was invited to deliver a series of lectures in her native Canada, a prestigious annual event in which a noted thinker dedicates a week to a particular topic. Atwood chose debt. Her new book is the result. It's called Payback: Debt and the Shadow Side of Wealth. And it reflects not just Margaret Atwood's intelligence and erudition, but her abiding commitment to the environment and to exploring moral codes. This reading of Payback: Debt and the Shadow Side of Wealth was recorded in November 2008 at the Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C.
It's a great pleasure to be here yet once again. We said backstage, there's such a big crowd. And I said, well, maybe it's because they all think it might be our last chance. I said, maybe they think I'm almost dead. So the answer is not quite, but my birthday was yesterday. They add up. This is a book, it isn't about economics. It's about human to and fro. And debt and credit are part of that human to and fro. So it's really about the human structures that underlie any kind of thing that involves owing, being owed to in all sorts of ways. Example, you say good morning to somebody and they don't say good morning back. How do you feel? You feel that you've been done out of the good morning that was owed to you for the good morning that you have lent to them. They owe you one back. If somebody opens the door for you and you go through and don't say thank you, you can bet they're going to feel quite aggrieved. They lent you an opening of the door. You did not repay them by saying thank you. And I think the real reason we teach our kids manners is that we somehow know that. We know if we send the kids out into the world without manners, a lot of people are going to resent them because they will be incurring debts of gratitude that they are not repaying. So it's about those structures and all of the ways in which they play out. For instance, is it more sinful to be a debtor or a creditor because both have been accounted sinful in their day? One little section is about revenge. Revenge is another one of those things in which we feel we're owed, but we can't be repaid in money. We can be repaid by watching somebody else suffer, unfortunately. And that's why there's a website now called thepayback.com, and you can go onto it and order up revenges. You can order dead fish in a box. You can order wilted roses to be sent to other people. They don't go as far as cut off horse's head in somebody's bed or corpse on the doorstep. They don't do illegal things, but they do these little mini revenges that you can get delivered to. We used to do that ourselves. We didn't used to pay people for it, but you can buy anything these days. So I thought I would just read to you a couple of little bits from a couple of the sections of the book, and then we'll take some questions. So this is towards the beginning in the section called Ancient Balances, which also includes such things as the Egyptian afterlife, in which if you were a bad person, your heart got weighed on a scales, and if it was too heavy, it got eaten by a crocodile-headed monster. We like to feel that if things haven't been paid back in life, that somebody's going to take care of it later on. During the past half century, I've spent much time riding around on public transport. I always read the ads. In the 1950s, there were a lot of girdle and brassiere ads, and ads for deodorants and mouthwashes. Today, these have vanished to be replaced by ads for diseases, heart problems, arthritis, diabetes, and more. Ads to help you stop smoking. Ads for television series that always feature a goddess-like woman or two, though these are sometimes ads for hair dye and skin cream. and ads for agencies you can call if you have a gambling addiction, and ads for debt services. There are a lot of this kind. Why are there so many of these ads? Is it because there are unprecedented numbers of people in debt? Very possibly. In the 1950s, the age of girdles and deodorants, the adsters evidently felt that the most anxiety-making thing imaginable was to have your body lolloping around unconfined and stinking up the place into the bargain. It was the body that might get away from you, so it was the body that had to be brought under control. If not, that body might get out and do things that would bring a shame upon you so deep and sexual that it could never be mentioned on public transport. Now things are very different. Sexual antics are a part of the entertainment industry and thus no longer a matter for censure and guilt, so your body is not the main focus of anxiety unless it gets one of the much advertised diseases. Instead, the worrisome thing is the debit side of your ledger. This is from the chapter called Debt and Sin. Debt is the new fat, someone said recently, which led me to reflect that not so long ago, fat was the new cigarette smoking, and before that, cigarette smoking was the new alcohol drinking, and before that, alcohol drinking was the new whoremongering, and whoremongering is the new debt, and so we go in circles. What all these things have in common is that one time or another, each has been considered the very worst sin of all, but has then gone through a period of being thought, if not totally harmless, at least fashionable. I left out hallucinogenic drugs, though they fit in there too. We seem to be entering a period in which debt has passed through its most recent harmless and fashionable period and is reverting to being sinful. There are even debt TV shows which have a familiar religious revival ring to them. There are accounts of shopaholic binges during which you don't know what came over you and everything was a blur, with tearful confessions by those who have spent themselves into quivering insomniac jellies of hopeless indebtedness and have resorted to lying, cheating, stealing, and kiting checks between bank accounts as a result. There are testimonials by families and loved ones whose lives have been destroyed by the debtor's harmful behavior. There are compassionate but severe admonitions by the television host, who here plays the part of priest or revivalist. There's a moment of seeing the light, followed by repentance and a promise never to do it again. There's a penance imposed. Snip, snip, go the scissors on the credit cards, followed by a strict curb on spending regimen. And finally, if all goes well, the debts are paid down, the sins are forgiven, absolution is granted, and a new day dawns in which a sadder but more solvent man, usually woman, you rise the morrow morn. Once upon a time, people took the utmost precautions to avoid going into debt in the first place. There were various once upon a times, but the time I have in mind was the Great Depression, which my parents lived through as a young married couple. My mother had four envelopes into which she put the money from my father's paycheck every month. These envelopes were labeled rent, groceries, other necessities, and recreation. Recreation meant the movies. The first three envelopes had priority, and if there was nothing left for the fourth envelope, there were no movies, and my parents went for a walk instead. This was called living within your means. And judging from the debt TV shows, it's a lost art. They used to get, when they would get a chocolate, they would cut it in two so that each one of them would have half to see what they tasted like. Without memory, this is from Debt as Plot, which examines, among other things, the plots of novels, but also just the plot that is debt, and it is a plot. Without memory, there is no debt. Put another way, without story, there is no debt. A story is a string of actions occurring over time, and debt happens as a result of actions occurring over time. Therefore, any debt involves a plot line. How you got into debt, what you did, said, and thought while you were in there, and then, depending on whether the ending is to be happy or sad, how you got out of debt, or else how you got further and further into it until you became overwhelmed by it and sank from view. The hidden metaphors are revealing. We get into debt as if into a prison, swamp, or well, or possibly a bed. We get out of it as if coming into the open air or climbing out of a hole. If we are overwhelmed by debt, the image is possibly that of a foundering ship with the sea and waves pouring inexorably in on top of us as we flail and choke. All of this sounds dramatic, with much physical activity. Jumping in, leaping or clambering out, thrashing around, drowning. Metaphorically, the debt plot line is a far cry from the glum actuality in which the debtor sits at a desk fiddling around with numbers in the hope that they will go away, or paces the room wondering how he can possibly extricate himself from the fiscal molasses. Scientists tell us that rats, if deprived of toys and fellow rats, will give themselves painful electric shocks rather than endure prolonged boredom. Even this electric shock self-torture can provide some pleasure, it seems. The anticipation of torment is exciting in itself, and then there's the thrill that accompanies risky behavior. But more importantly, rats will do almost anything to create events for themselves in an otherwise eventless time-space. So will people. We not only like our plots, we need our plots, and to some extent, we are our plots. A story of my life without a story is not a life. Debt can constitute one such story of my life. It used to be called paying off the mortgage. Now it's called paying off the mortgage plus. This is one from the fourth one, which is called The Shadow Side. And it's about what happens when you can't pay, don't pay, or won't pay, and also all of those kinds of payment that involve things other than money. Usually, in the literature of the past, blood. I started thinking about the subject of debt for a number of reasons, but among them was my puzzlement over a turn of phrase, one you don't hear very often anymore. He's paid his debt to society, it used to be said. Crime does not pay, we also used to say, optimistically thinking this meant that crime does not ultimately reward the criminal, whereas it might mean instead, pessimistically, that crime skips town and stiffs you for his bills. The rotten deadbeat. In the lurid, trashy 1940 crime comics I read as a kid, crime didn't pay. In these moral, though gruesome narratives, the criminals committed many noir deeds, usually in the glare of a single unshaded light bulb or two cone-shaped car headlights, but they always got caught in the end. If arrested rather than terminated, they were made to pay in another sense of the term. They had to do something called paying for their crimes. This phrase suggests a crime supermarket in which you can browse among the various crimes on offer and select those you want to do, take them to the checkout counter, render your cash or credit card, and then merrily go out and commit them. The equivalent of this crime supermarket has actually existed in the past. The Catholic Church once sold indulgences whereby you paid after completing the bad act rather than before, and the same sort of thing is still available under various names, Hell's Angels, the Mafia, and many another crime-for-hire enterprise. I'm told the terms are half down and half on delivery, but that isn't what paying for your crimes is usually thought to mean. And I'll leave you with that thought. And now we can do a little question and answer, in which you ask the questions and I give the answers if known.
I've always thought that you might enjoy the very short fiction that you write, as in Good Bones and Simple Murders. There's an exuberance there, a lot of humor, and that you prefer doing that as without so much strain rather than a novel or poetry even. Is that a wild, erroneous guess or not?
Well, yes and no. A novel is a big form, and there are always parts that you have to work at in which you get from the bits of it you like to the next bit you like, and somehow you have to get across the stepping stones to get the reader from that part. I mean, there's meanwhile 30 years later. There's those parts, which we've kind of learned how to do in films just by cutting. Although in earlier films they didn't do that. They had to sort of follow along and put in explanations because the reader likes to know, okay, what year are we in? What happened since? How do we account for this? You're usually dealing with fairly long stretches of time in a novel or with somewhat complex sets of interactions. So novels are strenuous to write. You might have a brilliant idea, you know, that takes you this long, but then actually working it out can take you a lot longer. And sometimes it doesn't work out, in which case you've wasted quite a lot of time and paper. So yeah, they're work. The Good Bones things are, I hesitate to say, one-night stands. They're more like they're more like bits of stand-up. You know, they're more ephemeral. And they're very varied. And in those books, you get something like those boxes of chocolates that say sampler, you know, so in the sampler you get one of each kind. And they're not necessarily prose poems, they're not necessarily monologues, they're not necessarily mini-narratives, they're not necessarily mini-sci-fi pieces, but those are all included. So you have a great freedom to fool around. And fooling around, of course, can be a lot of fun, but it's not necessarily what you want to be doing all the time. And that's how it goes, I'd say.
George Taylor, our host, asked us to come to the microphone so it could be recorded. American by birth, Canadian by choice. Welcome. The question I have is if you could comment briefly on the relationship between debt and forgiveness. For example, the debt for which there can be no forgiveness. For example, I have two children. If one of them was murdered, I would feel in my heart that there was no way that that debt could be paid by the person who did it. I haven't read your book yet, but I bought it. Could you comment on
it's in there. Motif is in there.
okay, that motif. The relationship between debt and forgiveness.
Exactly. It's in Chapter 4, but it's very interesting to me that we use the same word for forgiving a debt and forgiving a wrong action that has been done to us. It's the same word. Similarly, the same word for getting something out of a pawn shop, that word is redeem. You go to the pawn shop and you redeem the object. That is the same word that we use in the Christian religion. The Redeemer. So what does that mean? It means somebody who has redeemed your debt, has paid off your debt, and therefore has got your soul out of the pawn shop. The pawn shop of not being out of debt, but not being totally and completely unforgivably in it. You're in a kind of intermediate position, so I pay quite a lot of attention to the pawn shop situation. So there is very definitely a connection, and it's interesting to me that you made that connection without having read the book. But the antidote, in fact, to the kind of revenge, because revenge usually spurs another revenge, which gave us the Jacobean revenge tragedies in which this person kills that one, that person kills that one, this person kills that one. You get a whole sort of chain reaction of revenges. You can read about it also in the clan tribal wars in Huckleberry Finn, which two families are intermurdering each other, and you find that in the amongst the mafia families. I kill one of them, they kill one of us. I kill five of them, they kill 10 of us. It can just escalate. So the antidote to that is not actually more revenge, because you never know when you've paid enough revenge to even the score. The antidote to revenge is forgiveness. It's very hard to do, which is why so few people manage to do it. But it is a possibility, and the example I cite is Nelson Mandela, who decided before he got to the gate of his prison, he was getting out, he said, I have to forgive the people who did this to me before I go out that gate, because if not, they will control me for the rest of my life. The kind of revenge situation is, in fact, a kind of bondage. You're tied to that person. You're tied to the person who did the bad thing to you. So how do you get free? Is revenge the way? It is for some people, but it can have a blowback effect. Whereas there is no riposte to forgiveness. So yes, it's in there.
I'm a technical writer, and I work with 25 baby programmers who wouldn't read a book if it bit them.
Yeah.
But they spend all day long walking by each other's cubes saying hello and waving.
So doing social interaction.
Yeah, right, yeah. And what they seem to have is, and I think this might relate to what you're talking about, the guys who don't say hello enough are ostracized.
Yeah, because they're not returning the hellos.
Right. And it isn't even...
They're thought to be unfriendly.
Right, it isn't even one... Well, they're all unfriendly. It isn't even... By normal standards.
If
they're all unfriendly,
why are they saying hello?
Because they want to look friendly.
They want to look friendly,
Or they are all friendly, they're just a different
deep.
Culture. They're half my age, which makes it even more fun. But the real question is, how did they evolve this whole idea that you must say hello to somebody once in the morning and once in the afternoon, or they won't make your build? How did this happen?
I think it's very, very old. There's a piece in, if you want to look it up, look under Daily Telegraph, Chimpanzee.
Like the grooming stuff.
Oh, well, this was just last week.
Oh,
they've
cool.
they've got
cool.
latest experiment in having to do with chimpanzee reciprocal altruistic behavior. And it really is, I'll scratch your back if you scratch mine. And it does have to do with actual back scratching.
Luckily, the programmers don't touch each other.
Chimp A, but it's the same thing. It's
right.
a social pat.
Right.
Chimp A scratches chimp B. Chimp A is owed a scratch. And they both remember that. They both remember it, and then they dole out the scratches according to whom they owe. It's true. Scratches have economic value in the world of chimps.
So I guess food becomes scratches. Becomes.
Giving food for sure
is
one of my favorite things, and you'll just love this, amongst silverfish. Mm-hmm. You know silverfish?
Yes.
There is a little mating thing that goes on in which the male silverfish does a dance for the female silverfish. And if she appreciates this dance, he then hands over to her something called a sperm packet.
With a ribbon?
When I told my accountant about that, he said, I've got clients who would kill for that. But I didn't know what he meant. Actually, I should have asked him, but he died. I didn't know whether he meant they would be happy to have some sperm or they would be happy to be able to put it in a package and hand it over without having to do anything else.
Appreciative
But it is, and there's a lot of this stuff going on amongst animals when it comes to mating time, but it's the stuff that doesn't go on at such times that it's really interesting in social animals. They're not doing it to get sex. They're doing it to form social bonds and to have those bonds reinforced by getting a return on their investment of scratching.
Right. Do other animals know who's in debt to others as well?
Don't know that. The ones involved know. The ones involved know, for sure. And the other ones observe, and they will see that if Chimp A is getting a whole bunch of people doing some scratching on that person and he's not paying back an equal amount, they will know, well, he must be really important. And you can see this in the world of politics.
Why, yes. And in the world of programming as well.
In the world of programming, yeah, there you are. Tell them we're on to them.
Hi. Well, I did read your book, and even though it's not about economics or the current financial debacle, I found it difficult to read the book without trying to reflect on what we're seeing and reading about in the news all the time.
Yeah, it is kind of sort of about that, because that too rests on the same foundations.
So I wanted to ask you, do you see something in human nature perhaps that makes us maybe even cyclically overreach? Are we naturally greedy or grasping? Much of your comments and much of the passages of the book reflect on how things used to be back in the 50s and so on, a happier time, a better time. But then, of course,
I didn't say that.
The crash.
That's so different. You think those girdles were good? I don't think so. No, you
never
wore one. I don't think so.
But then, of course, the crash happened in 1929.
Exactly. Free spending in the 20s, the crash happened. People rearranged their behavior very quickly.
So do you have any lessons that you could draw for us from human nature?
Well, what we've just seen is prescient cover designer, the bursting of a bubble. And bubbles have been a recurring phenomenon in modern times. By modern, I mean since the 17th century. And typically they happen on a kind of shaky foundation. Somebody then decides that this thing that's going to be sold on is valuable. One of the classic examples is the Holland tulip bulb bubble, in which people decided that tulip bulbs were really valuable, and they were bought and sold for increasing amounts of money until somebody woke up one morning and said, it's a bulb. You know, it's just a bulb.
Right.
I can't eat it, I can't wear it, I can't drink it. I can't smoke it, and I can't shelter in it. It's not actually, it's just a bulb, and I'm not going to pay a million, whatever they were, guilders for it. And at that point, pop goes the bubble, because you are not going to buy for more money something that somebody else is trying to sell you.
Right.
And that's what happens. Then it goes down.
But then why do we never learn?
Because we see other people, it's like the... I hate to say it's like the monkey trading game. You see the other monkeys doing that, and you want a cucumber slice too. So you think, well, this must be pretty good, because Joe down the block made quite a bit of money selling this tulip bulb, so I will buy a tulip bulb and I will sell it too. And if you get in and out before it reaches its biggest expansion, you make money. But if you're caught at the top when it pops, then you don't. Down you go. And down goes everything else that's based on that, too. So it's an artificial inflation. And we do it because while it's happening, we trust it. We credit it, which is why credit is called credit. We have belief in it. So you know, one of the questions I ask in the book is, kids reading Peter Pan learned that if you clapped, it would cause the fairies to remain alive. You know, clap if you believe in fairies. And I say, are banks similar? Well, actually they are, because they are human inventions. They rest on our crediting them, on our believing in them. And as soon as we stop believing in them, we get the beginning of that movie called It's a Wonderful Life,
right.
The run on the bank.
Right. Thank you.
Money is a completely man-made, rather handy invention, but we created it. It doesn't exist outside of us.
Hi, I'm Terrell. I actually took a class on you when I was in college.
Did you learn anything?
Quite a bit, but one of the big questions that we had in the class that I thought I can actually ask you was how do you see yourself in the canon of English literature? You have such a vast variety of books, and have written so many different forms, from your comics to your poetry to your novels. And just like kind of at the end of the day, like how do you want to kind of place yourself in kind of the greater
well,
English canon?
Well, luckily I don't have to do that. And even more luckily, that never really sorts itself out until after you're dead. And it's only ever one moment in time in which it gets sorted out. One of the most popular books for a long, long time was John Bunyan's The Pilgrim's Progress. How many people read it today? But for many, many, many years, it was second only to the Bible. It was, you know, you'd have two books. One would be the Bible, one would be The Pilgrim's Progress. So reputations go up and down, and they're not why we write. And winning prizes is not why we write. Why do we write? Well, read another book of mine called Negotiating with the Dead. You'll find that we can write for all kinds of reasons. But I think mostly we write to the extent that I do because because that's what we do. And in my case, it was because my outlets were limited as a child. I didn't see any movies, so it never occurred to me to be a film director. I didn't know there were any movies. So that's the way I think it goes. You know, when it rained where I grew up, which was in the woods, when it rained, you could read, write, or draw. That was it.
Thank you.
I got into the habit early. I wrote my first novel when I was 7. It was quite boring. The reason it was boring was that it was about an ant, and not much happens in the first 3 quarters of an ant's life. The egg, the larva, the pupa. There's no action going on. But I learned how not to start a novel by doing that. Don't start with the egg.
We should. It seems like some people are particularly wired, I guess, just to use her terminology, to see debt. And sometimes they look at the world through a filter of what am I owed or what do I owe other people. And I'm wondering, do you find in your research or your own experience, is there a distinction with people who are either oblivious to what people owe them or what they owe other people, or as opposed to those people who are always seeing it as, you know,
have to even the accounts.
Exactly.
I think there are personality differences for sure, and there are also cultural differences, and there are differences in what is admired at certain periods of history. For instance, in England, among the aristocracy, it used to be considered admirable to spend yourself into a hole in the ground, because it showed you were a gentleman. You know, you could afford to do this. Spend like a lord, it used to be said. But then you would find yourself minus the family estate. So it varies according to the culture and according to the times. I was told in Scotland that somebody had a grandmother who would not even go so far as to take out a mortgage in order to buy a house. She saved up all the money, then she bought the house. We would consider that pretty extreme, but that would be extreme frugality and cautiousness. It used to be said of people who'd kept an eye on their debts, they're careful. But then people of a more aristocratic bent would look down on that, you know, penny-pinching, mean, stingy, etc., etc. So it's a question of attitude, and I think the experiences a person has had. If you've seen Uncle Joe turn into a complete puddle on the floor because he's overspent, you might be less likely to do it yourself. Madame Bovary, in the book, if only she'd learned double-entry bookkeeping, she would have been okay.
Thank you so much.
You're so
marvelous.
Thanks for joining us on Book Tour. For more readings and discussions like this one, visit npr.org/booktour.